You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Today, we're going to be talking to two icons in the history of conservation and pioneers of direct action in service of conserving the natural world. Paul Watson is founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, whose mission is to protect the ocean and its creatures. Dave Foreman is founder of Earth First and more recently the Rewilding Institute. Both have been on the front lines as activists for many, many years, as you will hear, doing work that, whatever you think of it, takes incredible courage and audacity. And their success has been remarkable. On today's program, they look back on their decades of activism and their assessment of where we are today as a society and a species. In the first part of the show, we'll talk about how they did their work, and in the second part, we talk a little more about the state of the world. It's kind of a long show today, but I trust you will find them as fascinating as I did. They'll be with us in just a moment. Support for this program comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a talk by Vijay Prashad in conversation with Melanie K. Yazzie on Wednesday, September 25th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic in Santa Fe. Vijay Prashad is a Marxist historian and journalist and the author of 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. He also is the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, a global movement-driven research institution. Tickets available at the Lensic or lensic.org.
Stellar, funky, and electrifying, the new power generation celebrates Prince at the Lensic on September 26. The original members of Prince's band from 1990 to 2013 perform a non-stop musical kaleidoscope of the most iconic, chart-topping hits from every era of Prince's career, featuring classic Prince songs like 1999, Let's Go Crazy, Pop Life, Nothing Compares to You, Purple Rain, and more. Get your tickets today at lensic.org.
I'd like now to welcome Paul Watson and Dave Foreman. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start here. How did each of you choose a life of environmental activism? Dave Foreman, let's start with you.
I wouldn't call mine environmental. I think of it as conservation, which is more oriented towards wildlands and wildlife than issues that affect people.
But, so that's the distinction.
Yes.
Environmentalism affects people. Conservation
right.
is for the species themselves.
Right. And that's how it's been for the last 50 years and longer. But I would say that conservation chose me as much as I chose it. 50 years ago, I was having a very bad time after having been booted out of the Marine Corps for inability to adapt to military service and various other things. And I was rather at a loss for myself. I did an easy rider motorcycle trip around the country with a friend. But then when I got back to New Mexico, was working as a horseshoer, but backpacking and river running, I saw more and more damage being done to the national forest and rivers and that type of thing, dams being built. And so I just naturally grew into it. And while I had spent a lot of time in wilderness, which was very healthy and helpful to me, it wasn't until I began trying to protect wilderness and wildlife that I've truly found my mission in life, my meaning in life. And that saved me, because I'm manic depressive. And no telling what I would have done to myself. But being that kind of activist just truly gave me a reason to live. A number of psychologists have said that the only way you can get meaning in your life is to find something that's so important, that's so sacred, even in a secular sense, that you're willing to devote your life to it or even to die for it. And that's how I'm alive.
Paul, how'd you get started?
Well, I'd also consider myself to be a conservationist, a wildlife conservationist, and not really an environmentalist.
But I began when I was 10 years old. I spent the summer in Eastern Canada swimming with a family of beavers. And then the next summer went back and they were all gone. And I found out trappers had taken every one of them. So I became quite angry. That winter I began to walk the trap lines and free animals and destroy the traps. So I never really had to make a decision about what I was going to do with my life. It just sort of happened that way. And then in 1969, I was the youngest founding member of Greenpeace. Greenpeace came out of two groups, the Quakers and the Sierra Club, peace and the green part of it. My motivation was completely different than all of that, because Amchitka Island in the Aleutians was a wildlife preserve. You couldn't go onto the island with a gun, but you could blow a 5-megaton bomb underneath of it, and it killed thousands of sea otters and seals from the shockwaves. And so that's why I got involved with it. And at the time, it was a group called the Don't Make a Wave Committee. And at one of the early meetings, somebody left and flashed a peace sign, and Bill Darnell, he said, make that a Greenpeace. And Bob Hunter said, great name for the boat. So we sailed up north on the boats, the Greenpeace and the Greenpeace 2, and in 1972 changed the name to the Greenpeace Foundation. Actually got the foundation name from Isaac Asimov's Foundation Trilogy. And then I left Greenpeace in 77 to set up Sea Shepherd, because I really didn't like the protesting side of it. It always seemed very submissive to me, and I wanted to intervene. So I set Sea Shepherd up as an anti-poaching group, an interventionist group, not a protest group.
You had a kind of Aldo Leopold moment where you saw a whale dying and locked eyes with this animal.
1975, we had come up with this idea to save whales by putting our bodies between the harpoons and the whales. And we worked on this for over a year. And then in June of 75, Bob Hunter and I found ourselves in a small little inflatable boat in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel. That was about 60 miles off the coast of California, off Mendocino. And suddenly there we were, blocking the harpoon with our bodies. We're here, we're doing it, it's incredible. And it worked for about 25 minutes. And then the captain came running down the catwalk and screamed into the ear of the harpooner. And then he looked at us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when we realized that all the Gandhi that we had been studying isn't going to work for us today. And a few moments later, there's this horrendous explosion. The harpoon went over our heads, slammed into the backside of a female whale in a pod of 8 sperm whales. She screamed, rolled on her side, blood everywhere, and suddenly the largest whale in the pod slapped the water with his tail and disappeared, swam right underneath of us, threw himself at the bow of that harpoon vessel. And they were ready for him with an unattached harpoon, pulled the trigger, hit him in the head, point-blank range. He fell back, screaming, rolling in agony on the surface. And as I looked, he suddenly dove again. I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming straight towards us. And he came up and out of the water at an angle, so the next thing was to come straight down and crash down on top of us. And as his head rose up through the water, I looked into his eye. It was right there, eye the size of my fist. I could see my own reflection in his eye. And then he did something incredible, as if he understood what we were trying to do, because I could see him make a move to pull himself back, and he began to slide back into the sea. And I saw his eye disappear beneath the surface, and he died. And he could have killed us. And so the very fact that I'm alive is because that whale made that decision. And as I sat there and the sun was going down in the middle of the Soviet whaling fleet, and this thought struck me, why are we killing these whales? You don't eat sperm whale meat. You kill them for oil. And one of the things that they wanted that oil for was as a high heat resistant lubricant for intercontinental ballistic missiles. I said, here we are, destroying this incredibly beautiful, intelligent, self-aware, sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it hit me. We're insane. And from that moment on, I said, I'm going to do what I do for them. Not for us, but for them.
So I find it really interesting that transition from protest to what you call aggressive nonviolence. And you became, in a way, kind of a pirate. Were you already a sea captain at that time, or how did you put together the skills that you needed to do what you do?
Well, actually, I majored in communications at university, but from the time I was 17, I was working on ships. I worked on the Norwegian Merchant Marine, the Swedish Merchant Marine. I was in the Canadian Coast Guard. On the first Greenpeace voyages, I was first officer. And so when I put together my own ships, I became the captain. So I was only started as captain of my own vessel. I don't have a ticket to be a captain, except you don't need one if your vessel is registered as a yacht. So all these years, I've been a yacht master. And I get criticized. People say, well, you're not qualified to be a captain. Well, yes, I am, but not in the sense that you are. I always find it actually quite hilarious that the people who say I'm not qualified for a captain tend to be fishermen who've never gone out of sight of shore. Meanwhile, we've gone all around the world and did all these other things like that. So what makes a person a captain is not necessarily a certificate from a government, but more the experience and the determination and the ability to do it.
Dave, you also had kind of a transition from working within the system, doing lobbying, working with the Wilderness Society, to direct action. Tell us about that transition. What happened?
Well, through the 70s, I was able to work very well with the Republican delegation from New Mexico on wilderness. In 1978, I spent that year in Washington, D.C. as the chief lobbyist. So I got very involved, and there were a number of people in Congress like Phil Burton from San Francisco, who was just sort of a god. I mean, he knew how to manipulate Congress. He was totally committed to us, and he was mean, vindictive, and would make that very clear, but he was a master at it all. And he told me once, he said, Dave, don't ever worry about me cluttering up your damn wilderness. I'm just going to save it. You know, he wasn't an outdoorsman at all. I'm not sure what motivated him, but Phil Burton had a very big impact on me. At the end of the year in D.C., I decided to go back home to New Mexico. For one thing, the Wilderness Society had hired a businessman to be executive director, replacing my wilderness mother, Celia Hunter, who was a longtime Alaska conservationist, first woman bush pilot in Alaska, and had been on the board of the Wilderness Society, and then stepped in to be interim executive director. And I just learned so much from her, not only about conservation, but just about being a human being. And so when she was replaced by the former agency bureaucrats on the board of the Wilderness Society, because she was a woman, and got this businessman who was just terrible, he ended up changing the whole personality of the Wilderness Society. And then we had played the system correctly for the Forest Service's roadless area inventory. And we got screwed. And so those two things, combined with my wife at the time staying in D.C. to continue being a lobbyist, got me really thinking about the troubles in the conservation movement, that we weren't asking for enough, that we were playing the game too well, that we needed to do something else. And so Howie Wolk, who worked for Friends of the Earth at the time up in Wyoming, and I said, we need to do something where we're arguing to protect wilderness not as a recreational resource, but as an ecological resource, and we need to move that around. At the same time, we got some people like Bob Langenkamp in Silver City, New Mexico, involved, and he had the most wonderful sense of humor. And so he discovered that a date coming up was the 100th anniversary of the Apache leaders Victorio's wiping out a mining town in the Gila National Forest. And so we hiked in there. He had a wheelbarrow on his back. He was an adobe mason, as well as many other things, carrying sacks of cement and a plaque, and we erected a monument to Victorio as the savior of the Gila wilderness. And that was the first action of Earth First, that kind of humor.
Right.
And several years later, some locals went in and blew it up with dynamite. But anyway, it was good at the time. There were many things going on in Earth First. One was the ecological wilderness. One was the humor. We brought music in to the conservation movement. But we also were standing up strong for things, and our proposals were much stronger than anything the Wilderness Society or Sierra Club were coming up with. And they would criticize our stuff, just as we would criticize their stuff. And our style was as tough cowboys, you know, rednecks for wilderness. And that was very effective because it just blew people's minds. And then we started talking about doing nonviolent protest. Howie and I blockaded an oil company that was illegally going into a national wildlife refuge outside of Roswell. They were doing it on a state parcel of land. But we blockaded them, and while we were blockading them, another group got a stay from a judge stopping the oil company. And so that was very nice. And then we went to work on trying to keep coal strip mining out of the Bistay Badlands in New Mexico. So those things developed, and then we got involved in the timber wars up in the Pacific Northwest, trying to stop construction of a logging road that would have split the Calmeopsis Wilderness in southwestern Oregon off from the biggest roadless area found that we wanted added to the Calmeopsis. And on one of those blockades, on a narrow road with cliff on the other side, my friend and I, he was in a wheelchair. He had lost his feet and hands on Mount McKinley guiding the frostbite. We stood on the road. We put a log in front of us. This was very early in the morning. First thing that happened was a deputy sheriff drove up and winched the log out of the way. And then he just parked. And here came the bulldozer jockeys and what was called a crummy then, which was a, you know, six-person pickup truck. And they tried to go around my friend who was sitting in a wheelchair playing Beach Boys songs to get at Jim Watt. And and so I stepped over there to the edge of the road to stop them there. And so they came back around and I went over there. And then they went on the outside again. I went back over there. And the guy just barely tapped the gas pedal and hit me in the chest with the truck. And I sort of pushed back and he just increased the speed. And so I got the world's record for the 100-yard uphill backward truck-assisted dash. Finally, my feet went out and I dropped and was hanging on the bumper like Indiana Jones. And they finally stopped and all six of these bulldozer jockeys jumped out and started cussing me. And one said, "You goddamn communists, go back to Russia where you came from." And I said, "But Les," the guy's name was Les Moore. I said, "But Les, I'm a registered Republican." And that just blew their minds and all. But then the deputy showed up and calmed things down. And I'm still lying under the truck like this. And the deputy says, "Do you have any broken bones?" I said, "I don't think so." He says, "Okay, good, you're under arrest." And pulled me out, handcuffed me, and took me the 40 miles on dirt road back to Grants Pass to be put in jail. Didn't do anything to the guys who ran me over.
Right.
So that was really my birth into hardcore activism, putting my life on the line like that and nearly losing it. So,
what was that like for you? I mean, I personally can't think of anything scarier than that.
Well, for me, I don't really plan something like that, but when I get into the situation, I have to fully commit to it. There's just no way out. If I'd gotten out of the way, then the next group of people who went in to stand in front of bulldozers, I would have shown that we would get out of the way. And what if they didn't? Then they'd be killed, and that would be on me. And so there was just no choice whether I lived or died. I had to stand there. And after that happened, a news service reporter filed a story, and the Forest Service and the construction company all denied that it had happened.
Was there press there?
Yeah.
So they saw it.
But fortunately, there was also a cameraman for the local news station. And so it ran on TV that night, showing the truck running me over. And so that suddenly changed everything. Construction company manager ordered all his employees, if they met protesters, just stop, do not interact, do not make threats or anything like that. So
yeah,
that really committed me to hardcore activism. But I also found out that I did not have the mindset for the classic Christian peace community nonviolent protest. And so that led me into monkey wrenching and writing the book.
One of the things that you both have in common, I mean, you were talking about, Dave, companies going into, illegally going into wilderness area. Paul, you have been working for a really long time to save whales. They're in a whale sanctuary, which seems kind of inconceivable. Why is that not being enforced? Why are you, a private person, citizen, doing that enforcement?
Well, everything we've done since 1977, since I began Sea Shepherd, is to oppose illegal activities. But there's a lack of economic and political motivation to uphold the laws protecting wilderness or protecting endangered species. The laws are there. They just don't want to uphold them. So what we do is to really expose that by our actions, expose the fact that they're not doing their job. As Dave had just said about how important it is to have this documented, I've always believed that the most powerful weapon there is a camera. And if it is not on camera, it didn't happen. So that's the only way you can counter the lies that they use against you. So that has always been our number one weapon in the field, is the camera.
What you're doing, I mean, you sort of call it piracy and take on the symbols of the Jolly Roger and some of the visuals of piracy. And you've talked about how a pirate put an end to piracy in the Caribbean, is that right?
It wasn't us that called ourselves pirates. Yeah. Our enemies called us pirates. So my attitude to that was, okay, well, if you want us to be pirates, well, then let's be pirates. You know, instead of, you know, having them insult us, we'll just say we'll claim credit for it and say we're pirates. So I designed the Jolly Roger, because every pirate had their own Jolly Roger. And so the skull represents what humankind is doing to our environment. The yin-yang symbol of the whale and dolphin in the head represents that we can find harmony in the sea amongst the biodiversity of life there. And the trident and the shepherd's staff, that's aggressive nonviolence, protection and defense at the same time. But I also learned a lot of lessons from the history of pirates, because pirates were not all bad people. Blackbeard used to attack slave ships and free the slaves and give them an opportunity. Go ashore, be free, or join my crew. And if you join my crew, you could rise to the highest level in that. So the pirates were the first. In the 17th century, if you joined the crew of a pirate ship, you voted for your captain. You could rise to the highest level based on your ability, whether you be a man or a woman or of any race. That was unheard of at the time.
There were women on these ships?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of women pirates. Anne Bonny, Mary Read. And so it was gender equality, racial equality on this. And people said, well, yeah, but they were thieves. Yeah, they stole gold from the Spanish. And where did the Spanish get it? They stole it from Native Americans. So nothing wrong with that. It was Henry Morgan who shut down piracy in Panama. And he was rewarded by being made governor of Jamaica. That's when he became a real pirate, you know, with all that corruption that was involved. But, you know, you couldn't stop piracy back then because it was so popular. In England, you could be hung for stealing a loaf of bread. If you're a 10-year-old boy and you stole a loaf of bread, you could be hung. So it wasn't a big jump for the average person to say, well, if I'm going to be hung for stealing a loaf of bread, I'm going to go for the big money, you know. And so therefore, it was the risk worth taking. Anne Bonny once said, you know, it's a death penalty for being a pirate. And she said, and thank God for it, too. If it wasn't for that, every idiot would be doing this, you know. So there's a long history of that, pirates who became very famous and very honored. Sir Francis Drake was a pirate. Sir Walter Raleigh was a pirate. The founder of the United States Navy, John Paul Jones, was a pirate. So the man who helped defend New Orleans, Jean Lafitte, was a pirate. So it's a complex history. The worst pirates, the very worst pirates, were the fictional ones like Long John Silver and the ones that were made up in Treasure Island in those books. But I've always looked on it as actually quite a noble profession.
You recently wrote a book about whales and the Civil War, and apparently the Confederacy, I didn't know any of this little piece of history, brought down the northern whaling industry. Tell us a little bit about that. You adopted some of their tactics.
Well, I learned a lot from them, because one of the things that I did learn is how to do this and not hurt anybody, because they of all the whaling ships and merchant ships that they destroyed, they never killed anybody. And to me, that was a very honorable thing. But what happened in the Civil War is that the Confederacy didn't have a navy. There's no way to challenge the superiority of the Union Navy. So they launched raiders commerce raiders, the Shenandoah, the Alabama, the Florida, the Patrick Henry. And their mission, go out there and destroy anything that has an American flag on it. And that included the entire Yankee whaling fleet. And in so doing, they actually saved three species of whales from extinction, the gray whale, the bowhead whale, and the humpback whale. And they got it just at the right time when their numbers were collapsing and just before the oil industry came up, which negated the need for whale oil and that. So I found in doing the research that I was fighting whalers in the exact same areas that they were fighting whalers. And they had the U.S. government after them. I had the Japanese government after me. And there were all so many parallels in that way. In fact, the Shenandoah had to pull into Melbourne, Australia to get repaired, and the U.S. government was trying to get the Australians to stop them. We were based in Williamstown near Melbourne, the exact same dock that the Shenandoah was in, and the Japanese government's trying to get the Australian government to stop us. So there's so many links there that I... But the reason I wrote the book was reading what happened in the Bering Sea when the Shenandoah stopped a whaling vessel and second mate Dabney Scales boarded the vessel to take command. And the captain said, "Why are you preying on a defenseless merchantman like me?" And Scales looked at him and said, "Because we've entered into a treaty, both offensive and defensive, with the great whales to vanquish their mortal enemies." Now, he said it as a joke, but that was my inspiration for the book.
And I think it's important to note that in all your work, nobody has been even injured.
We've never injured anybody. We've never sustained an injury, which, in fact, is remarkable considering the 40-year, two-year period of time. When I was in the Norwegian Merchant Marine for 1 year, we had 2 fatalities and 8 injuries. And when I was in the Coast Guard, we had injuries. So I think one of our big strengths is the fact that most of our crew are amateurs. Therefore, they're especially careful. You know, I think a lot of times professionals just take things for granted and they're not as careful. So safety has always been our primary concern on the operation of those vessels. And we're very proud of that record. We intend to keep it.
Dave Foreman, you were just talking about how you were involved in monkey wrenching, sabotage. It was all in service of the earth, of species on the earth, of
right.
Forests, of wild areas. Where did you draw the line? What was your moral compass?
To absolutely hurt nobody.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's what Ed Abbey had said. The first rule of eco-sabotage is nobody gets hurt. As far as I know, I'm the one who probably got hurt the most, just because I'm inherently clumsy. My cats have named me Bumblefuss because they think of me as a big, dumb, clumsy cat. And so that's just the story of my life. But we were very, very careful. And if you read Eco Defense, my book laying out how to do all these things, say this is not revolutionary, it's not subversive. All we're doing is defending wild things, and that under no circumstances do you hurt anybody, and that type of thing. It worked quite well. The thing about monkey wrenching, though, Abby pointed out, it goes way, way back, at least to Ned Ludd.
Ludd as in the Luddites.
Right, and damaging the factories, doing weaving, replacing the home looms. It was, the word sabotage comes from sabot, which was a French word for wooden shoe. And that's the wooden shoe thrown into the gears of the machine. And in fact, Ed at first was going to call the people in his book the Wooden Shoe Gang, and then changed it to the Monkey Wrenching Gang, because the British have the term the spanner in the works. And a spanner is just the English word for monkey wrench. And so all of these things, you're going after machines, pulling up survey stakes, and that type of thing. And it creates an aura that the press eats up on.
So you were also deeply understood from the beginning that press was a huge part of it.
Yeah, that what we had to do was make it not worth the while of certain companies, like logging companies and all, to go into wild places, because if they got damaged, their insurance had to pay for it. And so the goal was to make the insurance prohibitive.
Did that succeed?
Not really, I don't think. The other interesting thing about it, in Earth First, it was more the left-wing hippie types that got into civil disobedience. Whereas it was more the redneck Republican conservative types who were in Earth First at the time that got into the monkey wrenching. And I think it's was a split between group action and individual action.
Give us some examples of the, I mean, you gave, just gave a few, but some of the examples of this monkey wrenching sabotage kind of work.
Well, as far as what I did, putting sand in the crankcases of bulldozers, pulling up lots of survey stakes, spiking trees, but you always give a warning that the trees are spiked so that nobody can be harmed.
When trees are spiked, that means it ruins the ability to make it into lumber.
Well, yeah. In fact, I learned about tree spiking from a logger. And before we did it, we drove some nails into a stump and hit it with a chainsaw, and all it did was break the chainsaw blade. And so we carefully tested that out. The other interesting thing about monkey wrenching is that it goes way back. I ran into people in New Mexico who had been art graduate students at UNM that were taking down billboards in the 50s. And they had some hilarious stories about it. But cutting down billboards was another thing. But going in and doing machinery, remote, cutting down power lines that supplied a mining outfit, those type of things. Pulling up traps.
Right.
You know, it was basically small-scale stuff, but it was costing people money. And Christoph Mainz, in his book Green Rage, figured out pretty well from talking to the Forest Service as a journalist, but he was really an Earth Firster, that there were several million acres of forest that didn't get cut because they couldn't get anybody to bid on it because they knew things would be damaged.
Very interesting. You represented, as you said, kind of an extreme conservation group, environmental group, which in some senses allowed the more mainstream groups to position themselves more strongly.
Right.
In other words, if you were asking for 10 million acres, they could ask for 5 million,
yep.
Whereas before they might have gotten 20 or...
Our strategy was to expand the terms of the debate,
right,
of what was possible. When we put the crack down Glen Canyon, that was the first time somebody really came out publicly and said, let's tear down dams. Well, since then, we've torn down a lot of dams. Maybe not Glen Canyon, but a lot of other dams throughout the United States. And so I think that helped launch that. By asking for all the Forest Service roadless areas to be protected in 1980, which was pretty much put down by the Sierra Club and Wilderness Society, well, 20 years later, what happens? Bill Clinton and the chief of the Forest Service come out with the roadless area rule, which basically protected all the National Forest roadless areas from cutting and roading. And so by saying something outrageous 20 years earlier, it became more or less done. And then the whole idea of talking about wilderness and nature from a standpoint of these things exist for their own right. They are not merely instrumental value to people. They have inherent value. They're good in themselves. Got a lot more people thinking that way instead of instrumental value of nature because it makes you feel good or it's recreation. It has its own value and deserves to be protected for that. And so there were a number of things like that we did because we believed in them, but also strategically to expand the terms of the debate. And I think those things worked. I think that was the most effective part of Earth First, in fact, was expanding the terms of the debate.
Paul, you have engaged in some really intense battles on the open sea. And what's so striking to me is just how gutsy you are and have been all along. I mean, you said no when a lot of people wouldn't. Like, there's this one story where a Soviet ship is chasing you and says, stop, you know, and you no, and you just keep going and got out of the situation. Tell us some of those kinds of stories.
Well, that particular case was 1981, and we actually were the first people since World War II to invade the Soviet Union. And that's probably why we got away with it. Because I wanted to get evidence on illegal whaling activities. We knew it was happening, but we needed to get the evidence for the International Whaling Commission. So I anchored the vessel, went with a small inflatable boat with two crew. One of them was a UPI photographer. And we went towards the shore. And we were quite surprised that on the shore there was two Soviet soldiers patrolling the beach. So we just went onto the shore to get out of the boat. And the soldiers ignored us, because who else would be there? We had to be Soviet scientists. I mean, nobody else is going to be there. So we spent 45 minutes documenting everything. Well, they just walked the beach. They just ignored us. And it was only when we went back and I was about to push the other two out in the boat that one of the soldiers walked up and he pointed at the inflatable. He said, "Shoeta," or "What is that?" And I said, "It's a Zodiac." And he said, "Oh, it's a Mercury." And I said, "Outboard engine." That's what gave us away. So I turned my back on him. I said, "What's he doing?" He said, "Well, he's taking his gun down." I said, "Smile and wave." And the guy like this. And
Your guy's smiling and wave.
And so psychologically, you're not going to really shoot somebody who's smiling and waving at you. And again, you're dealing with a system where nobody wants to step out of line. And so he might be, you know, might be shooting the wrong person here. So we got back and we're feeling really good about it. And we're cruising down the coast of Siberia. And all of a sudden, two helicopter gunships come out of nowhere and started firing flares across our bow. And so I just ignored them, and about 45 minutes later, a frigate comes in and pulls up alongside us and puts up flags telling us to stop, and ignored that. And then he gets on the radio and he says, "Sea Shepherd, stop your ship, prepare to be boarded by Soviet Union." And I said, "Ah, we don't have room for the Soviet Union, we're not stopping," and just kept going. And I could see what was going on, you know, with navies. I'd learned my lesson with the Portuguese Navy a few years before. They don't know how to deal with no.
Yeah.
Because, well, that's not what they expect. And they could be making a decision that might get them to some serious trouble. So I could see this guy's on the radio to Moscow saying, what are we supposed to do? And by the time he finally got some sort of answer, we were crossing into the U.S. side and got away with it. So sometimes you just have to be audacious in that way. For instance, when we rammed the pirate whaler Sierra, there were 20 of us on the boat, and I pulled into the dock and I said, "Look, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to ram that boat. I'm going to destroy that boat. I can't say you're going to be arrested. Most likely you will. You might go to jail. But if you don't want to participate, you got 10 minutes to pack your bags and get off the boat." And 10 minutes later, 17 of them were off the boat. But fortunately, the two that stayed were my engineers. And we pulled away from the dock, did the job, rammed them.
Where were you?
In Porto, in northern Portugal. And we were then chased down by the Portuguese Navy. That's where I learned my lesson. I did give in to them. But I found out later from the captain he wouldn't have fired on us. You know, so I actually made that mistake of giving in to him. But then I was brought before the port captain. I was charged with gross criminal negligence. And I told the port captain, "It wasn't anything negligent about that. I hit them exactly where I intended to hit them. That was, you know, it wasn't negligence." And he sort of laughed and he said, "I don't know who owns that boat. And until I know who owns it, you're free to go." So I walked out the door and one of my crew said, "Well, if I knew you were going to get away with it, I would have been there too." So sometimes you just got to do things knowing you're not going to get away with it.
A lot of your work has been the work of fighting against Japan's continued ongoing whaling, which is such a strange thing that they're doing. They're harvesting whales in a whale sanctuary that they don't need, that serve no real commercial or nutritional or any other purpose. What's going on, and what have you, like, talk of this ongoing engagement that you have with them?
It's a complex issue in Japan. First of all, Abe, who's the prime minister, is from a whaling district, and so therefore he wants to make sure they're all happy. The government took over the whaling industry, they own it, and the people who sit on the board are all retired politicians who get six-figure salaries. They don't want to lose that. The union that supplies the crew is a Yakuza-controlled union and have a lot of influence on the government. The industry has existed because of massive subsidies. Approximately $50 million a year is given to them to do this. They have no real market for the whale meat. Most of it's stored in refrigerated warehouses. But here's the real reason, I think, is they don't want to give in on anything. If they give in on whaling, we might have to give in on bluefin tuna. We might have to give in on squid. So the policy of the Japanese Fisheries Department is never give an inch on any of these things. And also there's a nationalism factor. Nobody's going to tell them what they can and cannot do. But despite that, we beat them. They're no longer in the Southern Ocean. they've retreated and they'll not be going back. And we cost them about $200 million in losses, and we defeated them in court. That's one of the reasons they're so angry at me. We humiliated them, and their only thing is to get me on the Interpol red list on a bogus charge in order to keep me from traveling. But overall, we won the battle.
How did you do it?
By just being persistent, blockading everything they did, going after them, chasing them, pursuing them, costing them money every year, exposing what they were doing, getting this TV show to bring it into the homes of millions of people.
The Whale Wars.
The Whale Wars show, and just constant effort. I was 10 years to do this, just every year going after them.
And you're talking about going after them physically. I mean, like ramming their boats, sinking their boats.
Well, we never sank a Japanese boat. We sunk Norwegian and Iceland,
okay.
But never on the Japanese boats. But yeah, we went down there. We had one tactic, block their ability to load whales. If they can't load a dead whale, they can't kill any more. And so we'd just park right behind that slipway and prevent them from doing it. And that would shut them down. Also, while trying to find them, they would dispatch their harpoon boats just to chase us. They were not whaling, they're chasing us. And that kept them busy all the time. Constantly moving, constantly chasing them. In 2013, they only got 10% of their quota that year. And we physically prevented them from refueling. The Bob Barker positioned itself between the refueling tanker ship and the Nishan Maru and didn't back down. And what happened was that they kept pushing in. They crushed the Bob Barker between the tanker and the factory ship. And Peter Hammerstedt, who was my captain at the time, he said, "I'm not moving." He says, "Sink this ship right here, but we're not moving." And finally, they caused considerable damage to us, but they backed off. And that was the end of it. They went home after that.
You've named a lot of ships after the people who essentially gave the money for them to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we're a pretty small organization, so, you know, we can raise money from the general public for operations costs, but the capital investment to get a ship is pretty significant. So Bob Barker was because Bob Barker gave us $5.2 million to get that vessel. Chris Sharp gave us some money to buy the Sharpie. He wanted to call it the Sharpie. Not all the time. We named the Martin Sheen the Martin Sheen only because he's been a supporter for so long. So it wasn't that he bought the boat. The Bridget Bardot Foundation funded that vessel. So yeah, that helps us considerably in securing these vessels. It's a very expensive operation running these ships. And we couldn't do it if it wasn't for the fact that we're 90% volunteer. It's those volunteers that make it possible.
Let's talk a little bit about activism. I mean, both of you have been master activists for a long time. There's also been such a backlash on the part of government. There are things that you guys were able to do, you know, 30, even 20 maybe years ago that you can't do now. What do you think are the most effective forms of environmental and conservation activism today? How do you see young people engaging?
One of the things that we've changed is that we're now working with governments, and they're actually inviting us to work with them. So we now have partnerships with African countries, Latin American countries, where we can provide the resources and the volunteers, and they in turn can give us the authority to stop poaching and to protect their various ecosystems. And that's working quite well. What I found is that where we were at the 70s and the 80s, which our approach was considered too radical and unacceptable, is now no longer that. It's becoming mainstream. So we just have to adapt to just a different way of doing what we're doing. So that's been a positive thing, I think. I mean, the very idea that we would be in full partnership with the Mexican government would have been unheard of, you know, 20 years ago.
Right, right.
And I think the same thing is true about rewilding. Until the Trump administration, at least, federal agencies, land managing agencies in the United States were supposed to consider wildlife movement connectivity in their planning and their work and all that type of thing. And it's spread all over the world. And we see things happening like the recovery of wolves in Europe. So these things that are radical at first, predator reintroduction, connectivity and all that were really poo-pooed even by scientists in the early 90s, now are just, you know, accepted.
If people are listening right now, and most people are working at home or in their offices, they're driving their cars, they're commuting, maybe they're biking, but they're not engaged in the kind of activism that you're doing, but they want to do their part, what do you encourage people to do?
Well, I always tell people to look at what your abilities and skills are and see if you can apply those to making this a better world. And it doesn't matter whether it's through litigation or legislation or education or through direct action, that we have to recognize that any movement, like any ecosystem, the strength lies in diversity. So it's the diversity of those approaches working in harmony with each other that can change the world. One approach isn't going to work, but all together that they will. One of the things that the so-called, I never call them like radical organizations, in fact, conservationists or conservatives, but
literally more, by etymology.
Yeah. So the more controversial approaches, the one thing that I've seen that's happened over the years is that suddenly they make other organizations more reasonable. Like Earth First would make the Sierra Club more reasonable. Right. Oh, we're not going to deal with these guys, but now we'll sit down and talk with you where we would never have talked to you before. And so I think with Sea Shepherd, I think we did that with Greenpeace, you know, that, well, I don't know about the Sea Shepherd group, but we'll see what Greenpeace has to say. So these different approaches can complement each other.
Mm-hmm. In that. Absolutely. Diversity is absolutely essential. But take a person who's listening to this as they drive to work, that are never going to be an activist themselves or even belong to a conservation or environmental group. But they vote, and they need to vote on these issues, on the future of life. What kind of world do you want for your grandchildren and their grandchildren? Do you want a world that still exists at all for them? So there's all kinds of things people can do, but so many people who have a feeling towards, yeah, we ought to do something to save the animals and all that, but that's not their main motivation in voting for politicians. It's not their main impetus on how they consume. It's not something they consider when planning a family. All this other stuff.
Well, that's something that people can do, is they can have 0 to 2 children.
Right, exactly. And that's probably the most effective thing anybody can do. There was a study out of the University of Oregon that calculated, okay, if a woman, for example, recycles everything, bicycles, or has a hybrid car, eats only organic, has solar panels on their roof, all these other things, they still are going to have more impact if they have children than if they didn't do any of those lifestyle changes and had no children. I mean, it works out.
Yeah.
And their mathematical formula. So,
which is not to say have no children, but
right,
maybe don't have quite so many.
Right, exactly. Cut it back. For example, in my lifetime, and I was born in 1946, world population has tripled. That is revolutionary. It took from AD 0 to AD 1600 for the population to double, from 250 million at the height of the Roman Empire to 500 million in 1600. And then it took it only from 1600 to 1810 to go from 500 million to a billion. And so it's just been speeding up since then. And so now somebody my age, and I don't consider myself an old guy, I just think of myself as being rather beat up, has seen world population triple. That's just mind-blowing to me. When I first started going to Mexico, there were 40 million people in Mexico. There's over 100 million now.
And these have real ecological consequences no matter how well we manage.
Exactly. And they have real social consequences, food production consequences. But for me, and I think Paul, the real consequence is how do more and more people eating Earth, what is that impact and how is it growing? When I was born, certainly there weren't vast soybean fields in the Mato Grosso or the Chaco of Brazil. They weren't infringing on the Amazon. So as our population grows, our impact grows, but it doesn't just grow arithmetically. I think it grows more exponentially, particularly with all the new technology we have. We're able to do so much more damage.
But also there's a point of, not how many children, but the quality of life.
Right.
I asked a fisherman years ago, I said, if for no other reason, why don't you protect the fisheries for your children? And his answer was astounding. He said, "You know, in 5 years my mortgage is paid. After that, I couldn't give a damn. Why does somebody like that have children? Well, it's because it's what you do. You don't really give much thought about it. You just do it." And the real danger I see is so many people who are aware of the consequences are choosing not to have children. And therefore, the people who are having the children tend to be more irresponsible and really don't care. So that's reducing the number of children who are educated. And so I think that, to me, it doesn't matter if somebody has six children as long as they're given nurturing, love, education, and they're taken care of and taught to be very concerned and active individuals. The real problem I see in the world today is millions and millions of children who are just sort of unleashed without any guidance, without any nurturing, without any love. All these what I call postnatal abortions, you know, because we seem to be very obsessed with prenatal abortions, but nobody really gives a damn after that's over. And so what kind of world are we going to have if those are the kind of people that take over? So I see having a child as the most responsible thing that you can actually ever do. It's a commitment, and you have to stick to it. And I have two children, and I make sure that that becomes the number one priority, making sure that they have what they need and giving them the proper guidance. So it's the one, when it comes to children and everything, it's not black and white. It's such a complex sort of thing.
Yeah.
You can't just say, this is what you're going to do, or this is what you're not going to do, or whatever. But one thing I want to say about what people can do is they have to understand that they can change the world. Each and every one of us has the ability to change the world. I got a call about 25 years ago from a guy in Scotland. And he said, "They're killing seals up here in the Orkney Islands. What are you going to do about it?" And I said, "Well, I'm on the other side of the planet. What are you going to do about it?" And he said, "Well, what can I do? I'm just a draftsman here in Glasgow." I said, "Well, use your imagination." And we helped him put the Sea Shepherd group together. And he went up there to the Orkney Islands with some friends, and they were really enthusiastic. They walked up to the sealers, pulled the rifles out of their hands, and threw them in the ocean. All got arrested, but got so much publicity that we raised enough money to buy that island, which today is a seal sanctuary, all because one guy said, "What are you going to do about it?" You know. And so this is what we try to encourage people to say. We're not going to do anything. You can do it.
Right.
And, you know, like right now, you have individuals all over the world. Because they're there, things have changed. Because of David Wingate, a biologist in Bermuda, the storm petrel has survived. It'd be extinct if it wasn't for that individual. And mountain gorillas are there because of Diane Fossey. I mean, Greta Thunberg right now, she's just 17, and she's leading a movement on climate change. It just shows you what each and every one of us can do.
Well, and in India, there's a group of uneducated women that call themselves the Lion Queens. And they work in the forest where there's still some Asian lions protecting them. They pulled one out of a water well, and they have uniforms and everything and work for the government. But these are uneducated women for the large part, but they're just driven to do this. I've met wildlife and refuge rangers and guards from Africa at various conferences I've been to. And those are the bravest people in the world. They face danger every day, but they care about what they're protecting. And they are extraordinary what they're willing to take on because of their connection. And once they become involved with protecting a species, they really start to identify with it. And in fact, what we've learned is the most effective anti-poachers are former poachers, because they know all the ways and tricks and tools. And you get them to connect with the critter they were poaching and become its defender. They are terrific.
Very interesting.
And I get asked all the time, what should we teach our children? And what I like to say to people is, nothing. Listen to them. Instinctually, intuitively, they know answers to these things. Encourage them. Again, a few years ago, we had the opportunity to speak about whales at three different schools, or same school but different classes, in the Queen Charlotte Islands. They're all Haida people. And we went into the kindergarten class. How many people here speak Haida? Every one of them. How many people know anything about whales? They all did. We just listened. By middle school, half of them spoke the language, half of them knew about whales. By the seniors, nobody spoke a word and couldn't care about whales. So we've taken beautifully intelligent kids and turn them into morons through the educational system. And so we really need to encourage their intuition. You know, the greatest thing I ever think I did with my daughter was when she was 7 years old. I said, Lanny, I'm not your boss. You know, I'm not here to tell you what to do with your life. You're here to make those decisions, and you can depend upon me for support on any decision you want to make, but I'm not here to tell you what to do. And that, I think, has helped the fact that she's a very independent and creative woman today. And I think we need more of that. You just cannot force children into where you want them to go and to be what you want them to be. You just really have to encourage them where they're naturally guided to go.
And what I've done with my nephews and nieces is take them on river trips and get them outside. And now I'm taking their kids on river trips. And my nephew Gerard, I was taking him out on stuff when he was 7 years old and basically just letting him run wild. I've got some terrific pictures of that. But just let them connect on their own. Discover the world through your agency, but it's them doing the discovering.
And my daughter and my nephews, I got them onto the campaigns. They were like 12, 13, 14. And that really made a difference in their life. Mm-hmm. My one nephew, Trevor, he joined when he was 14, summer campaigns, came back every year.
So he was on the ship with you?
Yeah. And he was really got very interested in the engineering part of it, in working in the engine room. And then he went to marine engineering school, and now he runs the Dubai dry docks and everything. But he didn't know where he was going to go prior to going that. And we're not telling him to do this. It's just, well, what are you interested in and where do you go? And today on the ships, when people come on board, we try to find out where their interest is and let them go for it, whether it be in the engine room or in the galley or on the deck or on the bridge. That tends to make better crew members because you're putting them into a place that they really want to be. And so you can't dictate it to them. But the greatest lesson I ever learned was in 1973 during the occupation of Wounded Knee. And I was there as a medic for the American Indian Movement. And we were surrounded by, you know, all of these troops and FBI and shooting at us. And I went to Russell Means and I said, we don't have any hope of winning this. So why are we doing this? And he told me something that stayed with me for the rest of my life. He said, oh, we're not concerned about the odds. And we're not concerned about winning or losing. This is the right place to be, the right thing to do, and the right time to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're here. Don't worry about the future. Worry about now. And so that stayed with me forever.
We're talking to Paul Watson and Dave Foreman. We'll be back in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lano Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. Let's talk about the role of oceans, and we'll talk about both oceans and land. Let's talk first about the role of oceans in the global ecosystem. This is something that probably everybody should know, but it's important to talk about. What do the oceans do?
Well, as I always say, if the ocean dies, we all die. We don't live on this planet with a dead ocean. For instance, phytoplankton, which has been diminished in population by about 40% since 1950, provides about 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. If phytoplankton goes extinct, we don't live. And trying to get people to understand that has been very difficult, but that is the truism. The oceans make it possible for all life on this planet to survive. I have a different point of view on what the ocean is. Most people look on the ocean as the sea, but it isn't. The planet is the ocean in every respect. It's water in continual circulation. That water might be in the sea, it might be in ice, it might be underground, it's in the atmosphere, and it's in the cell of every living plant and animal. So the water in your body right now was once in a glacier, it was once underground, it's constantly circulating. So the entire planet is the ocean. In fact, we are the ocean. And that's an idea I'm trying to get people to understand. So it's all interconnected. When we first met with Dave and I, we decided that Sea Shepherd would be the Navy to Earth's first Army. And that's
Right.
And it was actually Edward Abbey who introduced me to Earth First, because he was an advisor to Sea Shepherd at the time.
Interesting. Talk a little bit about how the oceans have changed. I mean, it's been an incredibly rapid change, the pollution, the loss of species, and so on, that's been going on really within your lifetime, many of our lifetimes.
We've seen an incredible diminishment in oceanic ecosystems just since 1950, the year I was born. I was raised in a fishing village in eastern Canada. I've seen that diminishment. One fishery after another collapsing. The great cod fishery off of Newfoundland totally collapsed. And they just go one after another. And that can only be sustained for so long. Now we're hit with sonic pollution from fracking, from military testing, acidification, the coral reef bleaching, plastic pollutions, chemical pollutions, radiation pollution. It's under incredible assault. And of course, the incredible diminishment of biodiversity because of the world's fishing fleets. There are 10 million fishing vessels out there. 40% of them, 4 million of them are illegal. And they're just taking life out of the sea every day at every moment. And that can only go so far. In just a few years, there will be more plastic in the ocean than there will be fish. And that's the kind of world we're heading to.
And that plastic, when it breaks down even to tiny, tiny little pieces, is still toxic.
Well, it's even worse when it breaks down. It's microplastics, and it's consumed by birds, it's consumed by fish, marine mammals, and it's consumed by us. If you eat fish, you have plastic in your body. In fact, it's even falling in the rain now. It's in the Pyrenees a month ago. They found plastic falling in the rainfall. Last week, they found plastic in the Arctic, in the ice, in the snow that had come down. I remember in 1985 writing an article on it called The Plastic Ocean, and nobody wanted to hear that. Even Greenpeace at the time said, oh, that's just frivolous. I mean, why are you concerned about plastic? And Charles Murray, with his foundation, it took him years and years trying to get people to understand that this is a significant threat. And it's only been in the last few years that realization has come to the point where people are now actually taking action on it.
You've talked about something called the economics of extinction. Explain that to us.
The economics of extinction is that there's money to be made by driving species extinct. And the bluefin tuna industry is a good example, is that the fewer the fish, the more valuable the commodity. Mitsubishi has a supply right now of bluefin tuna frozen in warehouses that they could provide the market for the next 15 years without killing another bluefin tuna. But they won't do it, because if they were to do that and the numbers began to rise in the sea, that would lower the value of the fish in their warehouses. And if it goes extinct, then they've got a priceless commodity in their warehouses. So it's a deliberate economic decision to invest in extinction. Bluefin tuna is down to less than 10% of its original numbers, and it is now the most expensive wildlife product on the planet. Every year they come back, and the first one sells for $3 million for one fish. The average price is $75,000 for a bluefin tuna. With that kind of price tag, they're not going to survive, but they don't really care. And the reason they don't care is it's short-term investment for short-term gain. We'll take the profits and we'll put it into something else. I mean, the entire West Coast Canadian fishing industry is owned and controlled by one man, Jimmy Pattison, a used car salesman. So he doesn't care. Why should you just put it into some other industrial investment? And so you no longer have fishermen. You have corporations that are just using this as a way of increasing their profit line.
You also have cartels, like this story of this animal called the vaquita off the coast of Mexico.
Well, in the case of there, you have the same cartel dealing with drugs as dealing with the Totoaba swim bladders, and that's because the Totoaba swim bladder is worth about $100,000 a kilo in China.
Now, these are fish.
They're fish about 4 to 5 feet long, same size as the vaquita. That's why the vaquita get caught in their nets, but they don't care about the fish. They only want the swim bladder. The fish is thrown away, and the swim bladder is dried and sent to China. And the Totoaba is also an endangered species. And the smuggling of that is big business. That is our most dangerous campaign now. I think the one thing that we have to our advantage is that a lot of Mexicans are getting caught up in this and are killed. We had three fishermen who were killed last year because they just rebelled against the cartel. But our advantage is that it's not in the interest of the cartel to kill a foreigner, because that's bringing too much heat down on them. So I think that's one of the reasons we've been able to get away with it as long, well, we still do.
And the vaquita is this little porpoise.
It's the smallest and most endangered cetacean on the planet right now. There are about 17 of them left. and we stopped it. I think that the piquita would be extinct if it wasn't for our Malagro operation, and we've taken 150 nets, 150,000 meters of nets out of the ocean. As long as we can pull those nets as fast as they set them, I think we can save the piquita. I'm hoping the Mexican government will step up and increase enforcement, but the best thing they can do is ban the nets completely, just make them illegal. But of course, they're under a lot of pressure from the fishing industry to, you know, to not do that.
Dave, talk about, I mean, we've been talking about the ocean, but there's similar dynamics going on in our forests, on land. Talk about species extinction and just loss of population of species that aren't extinct. What's going on? What have you seen?
You know, the fishing industry is vacuuming the oceans. But on land, studies have been done that show that human beings and our livestock, I'm talking about mammals here, comprise over 80% of the weight of all mammals on the planet. So just us and our livestock are vastly outweigh all the other mammals, elephants, bison, mice, what have you. It's just been a revolution in what we have taken over. And 200 years ago, something like 7% of the Earth's surface had been converted to agriculture. Now, I don't know the percentage, but recently it was 40%. I mean, it's just vastly expanding. And so we're converting wild places into industrial places. And it's even getting worse now with certain rulers. I mean, look at Trump. They're trying to do away with the Bureau of Land Management, which is the largest public land management agency. They're trying to weaken all the laws. In Brazil, the new president has just opened up the Amazon for destruction. Doesn't give a damn about indigenous reserves or native peoples or the forest. And it just goes on and on and on. There's something called the Great Acceleration that coincides with my birth.
1947?
46. And things have just exploded since then. Its population, its land clearing, it's the amount of land that we're using compared to the amount of land that's left alone, the destruction of wildlife species, and that sort of thing. Just one example, in 1900, there were 100,000 tigers in India. Now, India at that time was a little bigger because of the British Raj. But now, there's something like 3,000 tigers are incredibly endangered. You can take the tiger, the snow leopard, various other species. I'm into little cats, things like the sand cat and the black-footed cat in Africa. Some of the little cats in the Andes, like the Andean mountain cat, which is sort of a tiny snow leopard takeoff. And they're highly endangered. There's so few of them left. Cheetahs are crashing. Lions used to be fairly abundant in Africa. They have crashed in the last 20 years to about 20,000. That lions now are endangered. And so we just see this stuff going on. The last of the northern black rhinos is gone. Here in the United States, in the 1800s, we wiped out the most abundant bird on Earth, the passenger pigeon. And we did it just sloppily. The bison, we came this close to the American bison becoming extinct. And the only reason it didn't was a few found refuge in Yellowstone National Park, and a few other ranchers gathered up the stray bison coming through and protected them. But there were fewer than 1,000 bison at the end of the big bison killing spree, where it's estimated there were 60 million bison in North America when we started killing them. There were 5 billion beavers in North America before we started trapping them. They nearly went down. There were 40 million pronghorn all over the West and on the Great Plains. that population went down to less than 100,000. And so just the amount of slaughter we did, the blood. Teddy Roosevelt wrote when he was ranching in North Dakota about a friend of his who had just ridden across Montana and said he was never in sight of a live buffalo, but never out of sight of a buffalo skull. And so those killing decades in the 1800s were just phenomenal. But we're doing it now again. We restore the wolf. And the guys who said, well, my granddaddy killed the last wolf around here, I'm not going to let him bring it back. And so it's the same attitude to destroy whatever we think is in the way. And it's the same thing about the land. Well, you can't let that forest just go wild. You have to manage it. It just becomes overwhelming what we are doing, how little natural landscape is left. We calculate up where the roadless areas are, where the wild places are, and there are places like the taiga, there are places like the Sahara Desert, really remote spots in Central Asia, the center of Australia, that type of thing. But otherwise, it's very, very small what's left.
Well, and it brings up some really important questions to talk about. And one is the question of population and the effect of 7 billion and growing people on the planet. And it also brings up the question of, is it a question of, you know, attitude and management? Like, if we just managed our land and our wild places and our food supply better, we could support this kind of population? Or is it kind of a zero-sum thing where, I mean, it's either us eating this available food supply or it's, you know, wildlife. For example, you, Paul, have pointed out that so much more fish goes to domestic cats and livestock and so on than goes to the natural predators of those fish.
Yeah, well, 40% of all the fish taken out of the ocean by humans is fed to pigs and chickens and domestic salmon and that. So we got a point where chickens on factory farms eat more fish than all the puffins and albatrosses in the ocean.
Right.
And we feed more fish to cats than are eaten by all the seals in the North Atlantic. And then the fishermen say the seals are eating all our fish. So, yeah, but, you know, one of the real tragedies to me is not only have we diminished and removed species, we forgot that they were ever there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That there used to be belugas in Long Island Sound. There used to be walrus in Nova Scotia. The sea mink is gone. The Labrador duck is gone. The eastern bison is gone. All of these species, and people have forgotten they were ever there.
Right.
That, to me, is a real tragedy. But I also believe that no species can survive anywhere. It doesn't matter what species, if they live outside of the laws of ecology. The three laws: the law of diversity, law of interdependence, the law of finite resources. We need that diversity to make an ecosystem strong. We need the interdependence of the species within it to maintain that diversity. And the law of finite resources: limit to growth, limit to carrying capacity. What humans are doing is stealing the carrying capacity of other species, diminishing interdependence, diminishing diversity. And at some point, that's going to bring about a crash because it just simply cannot maintain itself.
Well, and my feeling on that is I want to save all the building blocks of evolution that's possible before the crash, because I'm totally convinced that human civilization and human population is going to have a major crash. We're going to get our comeuppance.
What do you mean by the building blocks?
All the things that go to make the living world around us, and all the parts that will evolve in the future.
For example?
Well, lions have only been here 2 million years. They had an ancestor before that. The same with just about everything else. A species lasts on average for 1 million, 2 million years. But by then, they've split into several species or they've evolved. So you have to keep everything or as much of everything as possible, because we have no idea of all the interrelationships and who depends on who. One famous biologist, whose name I unfortunately can't remember right now, said, nature is not only more complex than we know, it's more complex than we can know. So that's essential.
Which is a lot of humility.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of humility in that.
Absolutely. You have to be humble before the wild world. And I'm humbled by chickadees. One of the things I do now, instead of howling like a wolf at the end of my speeches, I talk about how I'm multilingual and that I understand ravens, I can talk to cats, but I really understand chickadees. And when a flock of chickadees once flew up to me going chickadee dee 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 dee, I said there were all kinds of meanings in that song based on how it was sung and everything else. And essentially what the chickadees were telling me is, hey, why do you think you're better than us? Why do you think we exist for you? We're chickadees. We exist for ourselves. We're good for ourselves. You don't own us. We don't belong to you. And so people pick up on that. And I say, so what we need to do is talk back to the chickadees and let them know that we agree. So when you're outside, go chickadee dee dee dee, chickadee dee dee dee, and the whole audience starts going chickadee dee dee. It's so much fun to do that. But one of the things I see is, 30 years ago, some of us went down to Sonora for a bird watching trip. And the wonderful colonial village of Alamos, which is a great bird watching place, we were told about the Rio Chuchahaki, 20 miles south. And so we found the Rio Chuchahaki and started to walk down it. And there it was, the most magnificent tree I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen redwoods, I've seen alerces in Chile, I've seen baobabs, but this was a fig tree. And it was tall, yes, but its branches, it seemed like they spread over an acre. I mean, just huge limbs coming out, numerous little branches, and over a million leaves on it. And I was just walking around under this fig in awe of it. And then it hit me, well, this leaf right here is Homo sapiens. And this leaf is something else. This leaf is something else.
So it's the tree of life.
So it's the tree of life that Darwin first drew. And even though I knew all that stuff, that was a very visible reminder of me, and something I keep in my mind is that fig tree on the Rio Chuchahaki and how it is what the tree of life looks like.
Now, you are involved in rewilding. You started the Rewilding Institute. You actually coined the name, the term, which is now in the Oxford English Dictionary. Congratulations. That's
Thank
super
you.
Cool.
But explain to us. The desire of every writer is, and wordsmith is to make a new word that gets in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Explain the concept to us, and if you want, the etymology of the word wild.
Well, the word wild goes back to Anglo-Saxon and probably to its precursors in early Deutsch. And what wild means, it comes from will. And so I'm convinced that back then, the word wildior, dior, deer, was the word for animal. And so wildior meant a wild animal or one that wasn't a domestic animal.
So an animal that has its own will.
Right. And wildiorness, which was the original coinage of wilderness, meant home of wild beast or wild animals, home of wildiors.
Right.
And so I think that was a recognition that outside our fields and our settlements, there was this other world that was wild, that had its own will. And so to me, wild is absolutely tied to self-will.
And so in that context, how would you describe rewilding?
Well, rewilding, which has spread all over the world now and means everything from getting kids outside to restoring or allowing to be restored huge swaths of land, networks with wildways. But when I came up with the word rewilding, we were sort of involved with the ecological restoration movement. And there was a journal called Restoration Management. And they didn't really care about native species. They were trying to restore processes. Like, you wipe out a wetland here, well, we'll build a wetland here that may try to do the same process, but not necessarily with the native species. And so that, to me, was just awful. And so what rewilding meant was wilderness recovery, not recovery of this little plot or that little plot, but recovery of big areas, restoring their wilderness condition, putting wolves back in where they've been wiped out, pulling up exotic species so they don't go in, letting forests regenerate on their own, closing dirt roads, a whole lot of things like that, taking down dams. And Michael Soule, one of the great scientists, started the Society for Conservation Biology, said rewilding has three components: cores, corridors, and carnivores, which I would change into the four W's, which is wilderness, wildiores, wildways, and wardens, because you have to have enforcement to protect a protected area. And so that was the etymology of it, meaning wilderness recovery.
And so what is the actual activity? I mean, I think it's perhaps many people who are listening have heard of wildlife corridors, but it's important to talk about the fact that animals migrate long distances, and I just get sick to my stomach when I think about things like the border wall. But there's already so many impediments for an animal, a large mammal or not so large mammal, migrating from point A to point B, which it has to do in order to survive and to mate.
Right. And for us to have the interchange between Mexico and the United States, because the border is a totally artificial thing.
Right.
It cuts the Sky Island ecosystem in half. It cuts the Chihuahuan Desert ecosystem in half, the Sonoran Desert ecosystem in half, the Tamaulipan thorn scrub in the delta of the Rio Grande in half. It prevents jaguars, ocelots, jaguarundis, these cats that used to live as far as Colorado and Arkansas, and keeps them from repopulating America. It keeps the wolves, Dave Parsons and others managed to get reintroduced into New Mexico and Arizona, from interacting with the wolves down in Chihuahua that the Mexican government and conservationists have now done. It blocks all kinds of flow. The endangered Sonoran pronghorn can't go back and forth like it used to. So it's just overwhelming.
So what do you do? Like, what is the process of rewilding?
Well, the process of rewilding, for example, the Spine of the Continent Wildlands Network, is that it's an idea that from the Sierra Madre, even south, down to the volcanoes in Mexico, for example, all the way to the Brooks Range in Alaska, we need to restore the ability of all kinds of wildlife to be able to move back and forth.
And how do you do that? I mean, there's so much in the way.
What you do is that you identify the national parks, the wilderness areas, the roadless areas, and you try to protect them. And when you do that on a map, you see basically a natural network appear. But there are lots of barriers, like freeways, farming areas, that type of thing that you have to deal with. It's really the Europeans who pioneered getting over roads. Holland started putting tunnels under roads for toads migrating. Switzerland started putting underpasses and overpasses over roads for ibex. And so here in
things work. I mean, the animals cross the bridge or they go under the tunnel.
That's right. And in Banff National Park, Canadian government built a big wildlife overpass over the main highway in Canada. And trail cameras have shown everything using that. Elk, mountain lions, wolves, grizzly bears, you name it, going over that overpass. And so we're trying to get more overpasses and underpasses built. For example, I had an intern who I sent out to check out all the culverts and underpasses for streams, all the bridges on I-25. And he was up in Glorieta Pass checking out some culverts and crawled through them. But he found bear tracks on either side. So bear tracks, bears will squeeze through a culvert underneath. A mountain lion likes to go through a little narrow place, whereas deer or elk don't want to. They want lots of light and sun because they're afraid a mountain lion is waiting for them.
Right.
And so you have to do all these things. But one of the things I discovered is that you throw these problems to road engineers and they love it.
Right.
Engineers like tough problems. They like working them out. And so we got the New Mexico Department of Highways working with conservationists. I-40 through Tijeras Canyon by Albuquerque. Locals, Forest Service, the Highway Department, conservationists in Albuquerque all got together to work on that, to make sure the areas that went under the interstate were open enough for deer to go through, that they built fences along the interstate with funnels for pushing critters through the bridges and that sort of thing. They put some sensors into the frontage road so that it would shock animals a little bit if they got on it to keep them from going onto the freeway.
Because roadkill is such a huge problem.
Right. And one of the things the highway department likes about it is stopping the roadkill, because that's dangerous to people.
Right.
And so there were just all kinds of little parts of it to go in. And I think we're all learning a lot more about how to deal with these barriers. For example, there's a huge migration of pronghorns out of Yellowstone Park to the south in the winter. Well, that migration route has been there for thousands of years. The animals are really tuned into it. But it started getting squeezed off. And since then, through some National Geographic photographers and other things, people have really become aware of this. And so there's been a real effort, even by the state of Wyoming, which is not very good on conservation, to protect this narrow little passage between the wider migration corridor. And so these things are beginning to work. What squeezes it in is agriculture and subdivisions at a certain point. And it makes sense to people. You talk to people about wildlife movement and dealing with barriers and all, and I think it instantly clicks with people. Well, of course. Why did it take so long to figure that out?
Right, right.
Type of thing. And so what we're trying to do with the spine of the continent, and John Davis hiked the whole part from down in Mexico to the Canadian border to demonstrate it, is that we have to figure out both what's on the ground and what we need ecologically to let recover or restore to have these big wilderness areas or national parks connected, tied together by what we call wildways that sort of leapfrog on smaller wilderness areas or roadless areas. And then you deal with the barriers and all that so that we conceivably a wolf could travel or a mountain lion could travel from the Sierra Madre in Mexico to the Rocky Mountains in Canada.
Yeah.
That's the concept. Not necessarily that a mountain lion's going to do that, but we did have a mountain lion go from the Black Hills in South Dakota all the way to Connecticut.
Oh my goodness.
And then we had wolves go from central Idaho to northern California. And so things do move around. The important thing is to get females to move, because it's generally the young males that strike out and explore, and much less the females.
Interesting.
So you may have to actually move some females into the Ozarks of Missouri, where there are some mountain lions now, but they're males.
Do you think that we're having, like, real paradigm shifts? I mean, there's so many ways that we need to shift our paradigm from, for example, nature can't be destroyed, Moby Dick, you know, the idea that nature is greater than we are. Now we see that we have the ability to destroy it in really significant ways. The paradigm that humans are sort of on the top of this hierarchy of creatures and that we're better than everybody else and that the world exists for us as opposed to everybody sort of being interdependent and having a right to life. These are really major kind of philosophical and cultural changes that you guys are kind of helping along, but where are we at? What does it take to bring that into more mainstream consciousness?
Well, for a relatively short time, you know, we have shifted our paradigm from biocentrism to anthropocentrism, where for most of our history, we identified with the natural world. We're part of the natural world, just like any other species, no better. Now, we've been overtaken by this anthropocentric idea that we're apart from nature. We've created an entire world of fantasy that separates us
and technology.
From nature. But I think it most importantly is what we've done is created these fantasy worlds, primarily religious points of view. All religions are anthropocentric for the most part. And they say that we are, well, I guess we look upon ourselves as gods. And to do that, we create gods that then say, we're created in their image. But, you know, I think it's very important that somehow we return to living in with harmony with other species and therefore understanding that we're no better than they are. And one of the things that I try to tell young people, especially because they can relate to things like Star Trek and stuff like that, is look at the Earth as a spaceship. And it's on this incredible trip around the Milky Way galaxy. It takes us 250 million years to make one orbit. And on this spaceship is a life support system, and that life support system provides us with everything we need. The air we breathe, the food we eat, regulates climate and temperature. And that life support system is maintained by a crew of citizens on this planet. And we're not crew. We're passengers having a great time amusing ourselves. But the crew, we're killing them. We're killing off crew members. And there's only so many crew members you can remove before the machinery begins to break down and it begins to collapse and you no longer have a life support system. A few years ago, I had said on Fox TV interview, I said that trees and phytoplankton, bees, worms were more important than people. Of course, they were outraged about that. So how can you say something so outrageous? I said, well, because they're more important than people. Because from an ecological point of view, they don't need us, but we need them. If they disappear, we disappear. So we have to really recognize just how important they are. And if phytoplankton disappears, we die. If bees disappear, we're going to be very severely diminished. And so we have to have that respect for these other species.
I am noticing changes in young people, even though in many ways I'm quite alienated from young people, being an old cranky fart like I am. But when I speak on college campuses or we get high school students out doing ecological restoration on the ground with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, the message I try to get across to them is go outside in a wild place and try to reconnect. And that means leave your goddamn cell phone and earbuds and all that other stuff at home. What you want to do is be listening to what's around you. You don't want to be able to have contact outside. You want to be in the place. And so just sit down in a place that appeals to you and sit there for a couple of hours. Watch what goes on. Watch the birds that come close. Try to differentiate between the sound of a breeze in a fir and in an aspen. Try to see what's going on. Feel a kinship with it. It's a wild neighborhood, and there's all these neighbors out there, and you are just wayfaring through, and so you have to be really polite because it's not your neighborhood, and you have to respect all the individuals and species that are the neighbors in this wild neighborhood. And so that then gets to the point that's the basis for ethics nearly everywhere is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so let's transport the idea of neighbor to the other earthlings. And let's consider them earthlings. We aren't the only earthlings.
Right.
They are too, and they predate us a long way. Another thing I try to get across to young people is let's just talk about the rise of complex animals. We go back 450 million years to the Great Cambrian Explosion. Okay, let's call that a book, 450-page book. There's 200 words on each page. That makes each word 10,000 years. Okay, where are we? Well, Homo sapiens evolved on the last sentence of the last page of the book. Since agriculture was developed is the last two words in that sentence. And our modern age of industrialism and all that is the period at the end of that last sentence. See it in that way, and you can see how recent we are, how really irrelevant to the whole sweep of life. We're relevant in the sense that we're destroying other things. And
do kids get that?
They do. They do. I spoke at a university in Northridge, northern part of L.A., and it was ethnically very diverse, including some Muslim kids. And they ate it up. You know, I was telling them, here in the L.A. Basin, you've got all these mountains, wilderness, Santa Monica Mountains. You can go into these places very easy. You can take the bus to trailheads if you need to, and just go off and sit down and leave your crap at home, your electronic things, and try to fit in for a little while. And now whether they do that or not, I don't know, but they like the concept.
There's something also to be said for letting people know that there are certain areas you don't go into.
Right. That you have to just leave alone, that there are species that are so sensitive that you can't disturb. For example, a wolverine who digs a den to have her kits will do it up in the snow on the side of a cirque or something. But she can be disturbed by a snowmobile a couple of miles away or some cross-country skiers passing through down below, and she likely will try to move her kits to another snow den that's more remote. And so we need places maybe that in certain times of the year nobody's allowed to go. And we have that in certain climbing areas where during the nesting season for peregrine falcons or whatever, nobody can climb this part.
Right.
So, yeah, there are places that we should just leave alone. And I've often argued for within wilderness areas and national parks designating trailless areas where there will be no trails built and there will be no rescue. If you go in there, you're totally
you're on your own. Yeah.
We aren't coming in to even get your body. And of course, that's a little controversial, but it would leave areas largely for other species.
So before we go, I'd like to hear from each of you, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is the fact that there's so many young people that are involved right now, probably more than in any other time that I can remember. So that kind of passion is really very encouraging. And I see this happening all over the world, really, with young people getting involved with climate change issues, with ecosystems and whatever. There's far more awareness and I think far more involvement than any time I've ever seen in the history of our movement. And you can see these changes that are happening. But I'd like to say that in a way that's amusing is to tell people, don't get depressed. Don't worry about it, because there's been five major extinctions in the history of this planet. And what did they all have in common? It takes about 15 to 20 million years to recover from a major extinction event. I mean, the Permian extinction wiped out 95% of everything. And what happened? They all recovered. So no matter what we do, this is not about saving the planet. This is about saving us from ourselves, because 18, 20 million years from now, it's going to be a really nice planet. We're just not going to be here. So we're not going to destroy it. But we've got to do everything, as Dave had mentioned, to protect the blocks and that, to protect as many species and ecosystems as we can, to give the future the opportunity to recover from what we're doing. And hopefully we'll survive. But if we don't, the planet certainly will.
What gives you hope, Dave Foreman?
Smoking a cigar and drinking a martini in my backyard, watching the birds at the feeder. I mean, that's my flippant answer, but it does help. But going into wild places and seeing wildeors is what encourages me. When I was chased for over 100 yards by a musk oxen up in the Noatak, that was one of the greatest thrills of my life, even though I thought I was going to be killed. And that gave me hope that, boy, here's this Ice Age survivor, and he's going to stomp the shit out of me. And, in fact, a friend said, you know, Dave, I can't think of a better way or place for you to die. And that was the nicest compliment I've ever gotten. But I'm like Paul in a way of having hope that younger people will get engaged and do something we haven't been able to do. I tell folks in my talks that, you know, people my age, we've really screwed the place up. It's your job to take care of it now. But do I really have hope? I'm sort of a Cassandra in that I think I can speak the truth, but people don't hear. And with the Anthropocene and all, I see it as sort of the last hurrah for the human race. And I don't know how many humans there are going to be in 100 years. We are doing everything possible to eliminate ourselves.
But this generation has something different than all previous generations. They don't have a choice.
Yeah.
They have to get involved or they're not going to survive. So the world 50, 60, 70 years from now is going to be a far different world than it is now. And I think a lot of young people are realizing that that's on the horizon. So they really don't have a choice.
And if they don't do something, Earth is going to continue, but our civilization's going down.
On that note, Paul Watson and Dave Foreman, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about Paul Watson and Dave Foreman, go to radiocafe.org, click on New Mexican, and you'll find the show and links. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks to our sponsors, the Lenzic, the Lannan Foundation, and the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation. You make the Radio Cafe possible. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.